Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger, less than 5 miles away. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Folklore Podcast. I'm Mark Norman, folklore researcher and author. To the world, you are an abomination, a monster with unholy abilities. You're shunned and left to fend for yourself. Your only chance of survival is to tap into that dark potential. Would you do it? In an isolated mountain community, sometimes a child is born with two hearts. Such a child, a Striga, is considered a dangerous demon, which must be abandoned on the edge of the forest to protect the community. The only choice the child's mother can make is whether to leave her home with her infant, or stay behind and try to forget. This is the premise behind the book The Second Bell by Gabriella Houston. Part dark fantasy and part coming-of-age story, it draws heavily on aspects of Polish folklore, and in particular, it provides a new take on the Slavic mythos of the Striga. Gabriella was born and raised in Poland, where she was brought up on a diet of mythologies and fairy tales. She spent her summers exploring the woods, foraging and animal tracking with her family. At 19, Gabriella moved to London to study English literature, and obtained a master's degree in literatures of modernity. She's worked as an assistant editor and as a freelance writer. Gabriella's short stories have been selected for the Editor's Choice Review by Bewildering Stories and have been featured on the Ladies of Horror Fiction podcast. Gabriella joined me recently to talk about the folklore of her homeland and how it influenced the writing of her debut novel. So, Gabriella, welcome to the Folklore Podcast. It's lovely to have you along.
Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. Before we start, just take a couple of minutes, if you would, to tell everybody a little bit about yourself, your background, what you do, and where your interests in kind of folklore and history and those sorts of things lie.
So I'm a Polish writer living in the UK, and I came here at 19, which was a very long time ago, and I recently had my debut released from Angry Robot. It's called The Second Bell, and it's a Slavic folklore inspired adult fantasy novel about a Striga and her mother.
Now, you say it's inspired by Slavic folklore, and we'll move on to that in just a moment. But say a little bit to kind of whet the appetite of those people who have not yet read the book, or to summarise for those that perhaps have, what the general plot and premise of this story is, without going into any kind of spoilers.
So it's set in a small mountain community where every now and again a child is born with two hearts. Such a child is considered to be a demon, an aberration, and has to be thrown out of the village, abandoned on the edge of the forest as soon as possible. And sometimes the mother of such a child chooses to leave with her baby and join the community of Strigas in the mountain. So it's inspired, roughly inspired by the myths of Strigas, which are Slavic demons, but I changed it around, so it's not a straightforward retelling of any of the Shiga myths that exist in the Slavic folklore. It's I took certain elements, so Shigas have two hearts, and they have sort of unspecified powers, but in mythology they're pretty much straightforward bloodthirsty monsters. And in my book, that's how the community sees them. So if when the child is born with two hearts, it's considered to be a monster, and nobody quite knows what powers Shigas actually have, but they know that whatever they are, they would bring disaster and ruin upon the community. So such a child must be immediately expelled. And then we have two communities. We have a human community that banishes all Shigas. And then we have the community of Shigas living in sort of abject poverty, very high up in the mountains, pretty much completely cut off from the world. And because they are essentially the same people, they have internalized this idea that what makes them Shigas is evil. And should they try and explore what they actually are and what their second hearts can do, that would turn them, irreversibly turn them into monsters. So they kind of really self-police in that community. And it's all about the fear of the unknown and the fear of what, you know, you build up those fears in the community about what those people are and the results of that.
Yes, and in that way, I suppose it reminded me a lot of kind of when we look back at previous centuries, that kind of interplay within a community between people who were considered to be witches and other people, or people
still
that
goes
had,
on.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely, it really does. So, your version of the Striga is slightly different, isn't it, to the actual Slavic folklore, where it's more of a kind of vampiric, demonic creature.
Yes, so I mean, there's different versions of the Striga sort of stories, because the one thing about Slavic folklore and Slavic mythology is it's extremely fragmented, and you know, depending on which books you read, the accounts are often sort of self-contradictory, and it's very hard to get the kind of main canon, as it were. But by and large, yes, Shigas are monsters. Mostly they kind of wait for travelers in the woods and then sort of just eat them, attack and eat them. Some of the constants are that they have two hearts. In some versions, they have two sets of teeth as well. That's obviously in the folklore, not in my book.
Yeah.
And they're usually a version, there's usually some kind of curse involved. So either they were cursed at birth or their mother was cursed. And then they're kind of doomed to become Strigas, usually after death. So they will come back as Strigas. In some versions of the story I've seen, the Strigas are born. So you might have a child that's born with two hearts, two heartbeats, and such a child would inevitably turn into a monster, whether after death or whether, during its lifetime, that's not particularly consistent, but the fear that surrounds them and this fear of kind of the inevitability of them coming back to haunt the others, unless they're completely destroyed, you know, unless their like heads are cut off and whatnot, that is a constant. So in, you know, obviously this particular book, it's quite a small self-contained story. So there's not a huge amount of kind of outside world, outside folklore, and I kind of kept it small on purpose to sort of not overwhelm the plot line. But what I wanted to preserve is this feeling from the original kind of stories of this inevitability of disaster looming, of the threat that is constantly just there under the surface, waiting to strike. If you don't follow the rules, if you don't know the right things to do, and the laws to observe, then the evil will come out.
Now the fear of the Strigga in the original Slavic folklore is very much a known thing, isn't it? It's known to be demonic. It's known what they do. But you turn that around a little bit, because I suppose in some respects the fear of the Strigga in your story is more a fear of the unknown or the misunderstood. Is that fair to say, do you think?
Yes, I mean, that's very fair to say. I mean, obviously the Striggas do have some sort of powers. They do have abilities, not to sort of give away too much. They do have abilities that go beyond what ordinary humans can do. And, with any kind of power, with any kind of ability, of course it can be used for ill. Of course it can cause harm. So in one way, it is quite sensible to be concerned about people among you who are so much more powerful than the rest. There is this sense that maybe in the origins of the fear that kind of consumes those two communities, perhaps there was like a good reason, maybe some Striga was evil, maybe some Striga did cause a lot of harm, and that's why this kind of general prejudice came from. But again, we don't know that as readers, because I think when you kind of when really boils down to it, historically, when you look at like how do human communities behave when someone is born with a visible difference, not just not just there, but very different in the way they behave, or a visible difference, something you can detect, like two heartbeats in this case. Historically, humans don't react very well to that, and they do tend to build up a lot of stories and a lot of taboos around any difference. So that was one of the kind of reasons I wanted to explore that.
The Strigga need to control their abilities in your story, ideally. There are repercussions if they don't do that, aren't there?
They're very visible repercussions. So
yes.
Obviously, and that's not actually spoiling any of the story, because that's explained near the beginning. Unless a Striga suppresses its sort of stronger emotions, unless a Striga is very centered and controls his or her behavior, then the second heart might sort of become stronger, and it's all, and the shadow that is and the Striga's shadow can become in some cases almost corporal. So any kind of power that flows through the other heart strengthens the shadow attached to the Striga in a way that kind of defies the laws of physics in some ways, and that's irreversible. So should you indulge and should you try and explore the powers within your other heart, then your shadow becomes animate and stays that way, and you can't really You can't put it back in a box. You can't undo that. And that's why everyone around you in the community would immediately know that you broke the rules.
Another character who features very heavily in this story is the character of Dola, who has that as a name, but that is also a term, isn't it, as well, for a kind of midwife type character?
Yes, so doulas, I mean, depending on what you're reading, doulas were either minor goddesses or spirits that could tell the future. And that basically, doula in Polish, in slightly archaic Polish, means fate, essentially, destiny. Or the way your life is, to kind of explain it a little bit more. So not necessarily just what's going to happen, but this is your life. This is how your life unfolds. And I thought it would be a really nice sort of tie-in to have a community that lived sort of in between those two worlds, between the Strigas and the humans. And they at least lay a claim. We don't actually see them really perform any magic or beyond kind of reading from the runes. But they're midwives. They're sort of medicine women. And so they are seen as having all those abilities, but they are not reviled by the human community. So there's a bit of a discrepancy there in terms of how, intentionally, in how humans can sort of treat the same thing, but they can treat it completely differently. So the Strigas, you know, with their powers, the potential of their powers is not explored. The potential of the potential for good in them is not of interest to the human community. They are reviled. Whereas the doulas, who have very useful abilities, we know, you know, they're midwives, they are wise women, so they are revered. So that's, they are balancing sort of between those two worlds, and I like to have that kind of as a link. And as a contrast between how we're seen. So and yes, the community, all the women in that community, and they're only women, all the women in that community share the name. They're all called doula, and it's also a term for their function and their role. Premise that there's one fate for the world, so one name is good enough for them.
Is the figure of the doula in Polish history as a wise woman as strong as it is in British history with sort of village healers and wise women?
Well, okay, so doula, the actual creature in folklore, is quite obscure, so that is not. That is something I just read about. It's not something that like existed for a very long time. Mm. There were, of course, there was a huge, almost like in Russia, maybe not to that same extent, but there was a huge divide between sort of the agricultural lands and the sort of peasants living in the villages and the people living in the cities. So it was like centuries apart almost. So there's stories written by a Polish sort of 20th, early 20th century writer, Bolesław Prus, where he describes some of those villages, sort of village customs. And yes, they are wise women in those stories. I mean, to what extent they're wise is perhaps disputable. But they have their they have their kind of more mystical role, where they kind of link the old folkloric traditions and the old healing ways with the Christian faith in a slightly twisted way. It's one of those stories, and I have no way of knowing if he based it on anything he heard about or you know, anything real at all. But in one of those stories, there's a child that is sick. And the mother consults a local wise woman, and the wise woman says, well, you have to put her inside the stove for the time it takes to tell three, to go through the rosary and pray around the rosary three times or something like that. And the younger son is trying to rescue his sister. And of course, the sister is burned to a crisp, and the mother pulls her body out and is like, oh, the devil left her body too quickly. So unfortunately it didn't work. But that's, so there's an interesting kind of dissociation from the old sort of the way we understand like a wise woman or medicine woman here on in different cultures where there's actual evidence of their experience. I think it's not seen in the same way in the Polish countryside. But yes, of course there's always people who claim to have knowledge beyond their peers.
Oh yes,
situations, and it's not always accurate, unfortunately.
No, indeed. So the dolas in your story are actually more respected than the Polish wise women of history,
because they actually, like, you know they have a quiet competence about them. So it's like here, you know, I was actually thinking about the medicine women here in a kind of pre-puritanical rule, where Cromwell basically, under Cromwell's rule, women were forbidden from taking payment for providing any services to do with sort of medical needs or midwifery, and infant death and childbirth death tripled or quadrupled or something over like a course of like 5 years, something. And which is obviously evidence of the real skills that those women brought to their villages, to their towns, and that was kind of taken away. And so the dolas are much more obviously inspired by that, this kind of quiet competence of their healing abilities, but not much supernatural. They do give themselves a kind of those supernatural airs that they can tell the future, but they can see, you know, see what's going to happen. And then, you know, and then for sure they do believe it to an extent. We do see the like evidence that they do believe that they have those abilities. But as readers, it's like, you know, I leave it up to you whether you think that they do have those abilities or not.
Yeah. Your main protagonist, Salka, also has an animal friend in Munu, or Falcon. Are you using that as a pure story mechanism, or do animals in Polish folklore have a role to play in stories in the same way as in your book?
So of course animals feature very heavily in Slavic folklore, and I think they, you know, animals feature heavily in many in all folklores around the world,
well,
I
yes,
would probably
yes.
expect.
Yeah.
In different ways. It's, you know, it's mostly sort of, they're mostly separated into the useful farm yard kind, but obviously you don't want to get too close to the farmyard animals for obvious reasons. Not emotionally at least, but and there's always this sense of like there might be a demonic presence in the dog or in the cat or, you know, something like that. So Munu is but the role of the bird in my story is slightly different. So it's I like to draw kind of parallels, parallel storylines, and Munu is rescued, so it's like basically like a hatchling that has no business surviving at all. And Sauka's mother just takes it on. At the same time, she sort of joins this new life that she's really terrified of. She decides to leave her hometown with her infant, but she doesn't know whether this infant is some kind of evil being or not. But she just knows this is my child, so I'm going to leave. And hopefully the child doesn't turn out to be a monster. And so she takes on this falcon. Of course, the falcon does survive and does thrive and becomes her daughter's companion. So there's all those kind of, like, you know, who do we choose to sort of help, and when and under what circumstances we choose to help another being. That is a very kind of important theme for me. And also the fact that Muno is like acts as a benchmark for Salka to kind of gauge her own. There's a period in the story where she's away from her community, and it's just this, we always judge ourselves against something. So, you know, are we doing the right thing? Are we not doing the right thing? Is this a natural thing to do? Is this not a natural thing to do? And for Salka, those questions are crucial. They're very, very important to her sense of identity, to her sense of self. And Muno provides a kind of benchmark, because he's a natural creature, and the way he reacts to different things can either scare her or give her a sense of comfort. It's like this kind of guiding animal, like that shows you the right way to go. Whether, of course, that's in her head, again, it's, you know, this is, but this is the role he plays for her.
And there are lots of questions like that, I think, that you very much leave it down to the reader to make their own interpretation as to what exactly is happening. Which
I think it's more fun this way.
Oh,
to be honest.
Yes, absolutely.
We did an episode on the podcast last year about Slavic witchcraft, and witchcraft and magic in Slavic tradition is still, you know, very, very much alive and being, you know, used and studied in various places. What's the kind of role of folklore generally within Slavic life in modern times? Does it have any importance? Is it down to just kind of national tradition that it's important, or are people still very, you know, superstitious or very culturally aware of that side of their past?
Well, so it comes and goes in waves, really. So at the moment there is a bit of a sort of neo-paganism kind of renaissance, as more young people kind of turn away from the Catholic Church. They find like they look to the old traditions as out of interest, out of kind of sense of belonging to sort of some kind of like national identity. There's been, you know, long periods in Polish history and still are, where the Catholic Church, you know, tried to very actively not just discourage but erase the pre-Christian beliefs and traditions, and which is, you know, essentially why what we have now in terms of what's been preserved is just so fragmented, and it's so, you know, it requires the combined efforts of archaeologists and linguists and ethnographers to kind of try and build up an image of what those beliefs were before the advent of Christianity and sort of what's now Poland. But and not just Poland generally, like, you know, Eastern Europe. But there's So people do every now and again, there's like a fashion for trying to kind of rediscover the roots. There was, what did they call it? It wasn't Slavic Renaissance. It was, It might come back to me. In the kind of late 19th century, there was this renewed interest in folklore and in the old Slavic beliefs and traditions. And throughout history, you would have like certain, like our famous romantic kind of poet, Mickiewicz, wrote about Jada, which is the pagan holiday, well, pagan, it's like, well, pre-Christian holiday kind of where you can commune with the dead, spirits of the dead. And that is now pointed to as one of those kind of bulwark, like, look, this is how this was done. I mean, obviously it's like a long poetic kind of version of it, but yeah. That's how little we know for sure. So there are a lot of movements at the moment that I've seen around where people try and you know, perform those old rites, and there's certain things like this Andrzejki holiday where you would pour wax through the key and try to tell your future from whatever shape the wax makes, or we have the drowning of Marzanna in the spring, sort of in March, I think, in March, where you would take this hay effigy and drown it in the river, and that sort of symbolizes the coming of spring and the and the death of winter. I mean, that small ritual is all that's left of a much bigger worship of Marzanna or Morana, as she was called in kind of southern Slavic states, I think, who was this, according to some sources, this powerful goddess of death and rebirth and blood and motherhood and all that. So, but we know very little of it, and all that's left at the moment, all that people do now, really, is just drown the hay effigy. So it's a complicated question because the fashion for it comes and goes.
Yes. Is
you know, when I was very young, there was the fashion went sort of the opposite way. So obviously, I mean, we would read the stories. You know, my parents got me like story books and all that had Slavic fairy tales in them, but when it comes to kind of folkloric traditions, those would sometimes be looked down upon because they're seen as they're folk traditions, so they're kind of they're non-urban, they're not modern, they're kind of seen as slightly backwards looking, and so you have, you know, a few decades where it's seen as highly unfashionable to be interested in Slavic dancing or music or anything like that, and now it's kind of swinging pendulums, sort of swing the opposite way, where people are quite interested in that and see the magic and the power of those rituals and that music and all of that.
But it's interesting to see those parallels, isn't it? I mean, you know, the wax divination custom, the straw effigy, they're all very similar to things that you find in other countries. And, you know, even the view of these things as being rural and backward is no different to anywhere else. It's interesting to see, you know, across the board how these things sort of move and change. The Second Bell was your debut novel, as you said at the start. How did you find the whole process? Did you enjoy writing it? Have you enjoyed the reception that it's had?
I mean, I really enjoyed writing it. Otherwise, I wouldn't have done it. I don't tend to do things I don't enjoy doing for very long, at least not for as long as it takes to write a whole book.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the process of finding an agent was quite long, but then I was very lucky to sign with John Baker from Bell & Max Martin. He's a really enthusiastic guy, and he's just really lovely. So I really got on well with him, and And actually, we got an offer once he sent it out, once we'd done the edits together. We got an offer within a couple weeks, I think 2-3 weeks. So it was really lucky that everything kind of, you know, fell into place in the way it did. And the Angry Robot team are really amazing. I mean, I loved doing the edits with Eleanor Teasdale. She's, you know, I really vibed with her edits, and I thought she was wonderful. And then I had the Caroline Lamb, who's her publicist. I mean, the amount of work she's done. I mean, I had worked in publishing before, so I was kind of expecting myself for nothing. You know, like I just. So I didn't know how much marketing I would get. I didn't know how much they would be willing to kind of work with me to try and maximize the publicity or whatever. And I was so pleasantly surprised. So it was a lovely experience working with them. Really lovely. I mean, you know, I hope that people like it. The reviews in the kind of blogs and newspapers were really good. So fingers crossed it kind of continues this way. Obviously COVID has been less than brilliant.
Well, it's not been great. It's not been great for any of us as authors, certainly, particularly putting books out in the last 18 months.
Yes, I mean, it did come out sort of in the middle of the third lockdown. So obviously bookshops have really struggled to kind of catch up with stocking. So, you know, of course you can still like get it from all the bookshops online.
Yes.
They all sell it. But just there haven't been that many that were able to sort of catch up and get in the shops because so much had come out in 3 months. So,
but now is a really great time to support your local independent bookshop, and there's a great way of doing it is to go and get a copy of this. I certainly thoroughly enjoyed it, and I would recommend that anybody else does go and get a copy. No, it was wonderful. It was really good. So can we expect more from you in a similar vein in the future?
Absolutely. I can't, I'm not yet allowed to talk about it.
No, of course.
But there will be things. There will be things, and I will shout about them.
And will the things include folklore?
Of course.
There we go. That's good enough for me.
I'm not quite done with Slavic folklore yet. I like how dark it is. It's very twisted. It's very, it's a bit misanthropic at points, but it's so I'm not quite done with it yet.
No. There's a very rich vein to tap into there for future books. I'm sure, and we shall certainly look forward to seeing what you come up with next time. Let's leave it at that. Gabriella, thank you so much for taking the time to come and talk to us about The Second Bell. It's been wonderful to chat to you.
It's been a pleasure.
My thanks to Gabriella for a fascinating talk on Slavic folklore, and to you for joining us once again. Please remember that you can support the work of all of our projects to preserve and protect our folklore and heritage with a small one-off donation on our website, or by joining us at patreon.com/thefolklorepodcast for extra content. And by sharing our content and leaving a review, you can draw more people to the show too. Thanks as always for your support. If you enjoy what we do, please help us to carry on. I look forward to welcoming you back for another episode very soon. Thanks for listening, and see you next time. The Folklore Podcast is part of the Folklore Network.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.